Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we are reading from the September 19th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have President Donald Trump in the war room. He is in full military garb. He looks kind of like one of those South American military dictators. He has a look of concentration on his face. He's leaning over a colored map of the Western Hemisphere, and he's moving around military pieces. He's got soldiers and armored vehicles, looks like D.C., Chicago, L.A. And then something's going on in South America. He's pushing around boats and airplanes. The headline is Wartime President. Trump expands his use of military force abroad and at home. That shows up a number of times today, including the first main story. We'll start right there. Trump sends ICE into Chicago and Boston. What happened? The Trump administration launched its long-promised immigration crackdown in Chicago this week as President Trump threatened the city with war, and immigration and customs enforcement agents ramped up operations in other Democratic-run cities. Just before announcing Operation Midway Blitz, Trump posted on social media an AI-generated image of him in an Apocalypse Now-like battle scene in Chicago. "I love the smell of deportations in the morning," read a caption, in which he declared that the nation's third-largest city would soon find out why he's rebranding the Department of Defense as the Department of War. Trump later said he didn't intend to go to war in Chicago, but warned he could deploy the National Guard to straighten it out. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker vowed that his state won't be intimidated by a wannabe dictator. Federal immigration officials also began an immigration enforcement surge in Massachusetts, arresting dozens of people in Boston and surrounding areas. Meanwhile, ICE agents arrested nearly 500 workers, most of them South Korean engineers or specialist equipment installers, in a raid on the construction site of a Hyundai battery plant outside Savannah, Georgia. Latino residents of Los Angeles braced for more arrests in their communities after the Supreme Court upheld the legality of roving ICE patrols in Southern California, with Justice Brett Kavanaugh saying ethnicity and English language proficiency were common sense factors that agents could consider when deciding who to detain and question. In a forceful dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor decried the idea that the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, saying she refused to stand idly by while our constitutional freedoms are lost. What the editorial said. "We Chicagoans are tired of Trump's disgusting, unhinged rhetoric," said the Chicago Tribune. "He claims we live in the world's most dangerous city, even though our regrettably high murder rate is nonetheless not even a third of the rate in red state cities such as St. Louis or Jackson, Mississippi. We just have to hope that the president's threats are mere bluster and that Chicago will escape an invasion by its own government. Trump has shown Democratic-run cities that the streets can be made safer if political leaders have the will," said the Wall Street Journal. "Crime has dropped in D.C. since he deployed National Guards and federal agents, showing how potential offenders can be deterred by more visible policing. But Trump is overreaching in his immigration crackdown. The Hyundai plant raid hinged on a few visa technicalities and could end up discouraging billions of dollars in future foreign investment. Voters were promised a crackdown on criminal gangs or murderers, not legal workplaces." What the columnist said. To see how low our current anti-immigrant panic has brought us, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg, look to the Supreme Court. The Constitution's guarantee of equal protection means no one should fear arrest simply because they look or sound different from some stereotypical American. But the court's shameful 6-3 order all but greenlights racial profiling of all Americans, not just Latinos. You too could be arrested and required to prove your citizenship at any moment if you look or sound like you fit some hypothetical profile. Look, no one is rounded up solely based on ethnicity, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. The court's decision simply allows a suspect's Latin American origin, and most undocumented migrants in Los Angeles are Latino, to count among the articulable facts an officer can use when deciding to question their immigration status. Democrats also need to calm down about the National Guard deployments, said Dace Potus in USA Today. In D.C., we've seen them strolling idly around monuments and picking up trash. This is legally dubious and does little to combat crime, but it's not the end of democracy. Nobody should get used to such scenes, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. During last year's campaign, conservatives scoffed at the mere idea of Trump putting U.S. cities under military occupation. Yet here we are. The deployments are useful for Trump now, distracting voters from the Trump session caused by his tariffs. But it's more than a distraction. Trump is trying to normalize the sight of soldiers in U.S. cities, and it seems inevitable he'll order more deployments in the 2026 midterms to depress turnout in Democratic areas. All of us need to remember that none of this is normal. And we will pick up the second main story this morning. RFK Jr.'s anti-vaccine crusade comes under fire. What happened? Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. faced mounting resistance to his anti-vaccine campaign this week after a contentious congressional hearing in which he faced sharp bipartisan questioning about the chaos he has created in the nation's public health agencies. Kennedy was combative during the three-hour hearing as he was grilled about his contradictory statements on vaccines and accused of lying in his confirmation hearings when he vowed he would not restrict vaccine access. You promised to uphold the highest standards for vaccines, said Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming. Since then, I've grown deeply concerned. Kennedy doubled down on the false claims that mRNA vaccines are deadly and dismissed concerns about people being unable to get COVID vaccines as crazy talk. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, said Kennedy is deluded by junk science and fringe conspiracies and warned kids are going to die because of it. The Senate Health Committee was set to hear testimony from Susan Menares, whom Kennedy fired just 28 days after she was confirmed as CDC director. Menares has accused Kennedy of waging a deliberate effort to weaken Americans' public health system and vaccine protections. She said she was forced out after refusing his demand that she rubber stamp in advance the recommendations of a vaccine panel Kennedy had stocked with people with anti-vaccine views. Four top CDC officials resigned over her ouster and other Kennedy actions, which include firing the CDC's entire 17-member vaccine advisory panel, canceling $500 million in research on mRNA vaccines, and severely limiting access to COVID shots. More than 20 health associations and medical groups and 9 former CDC directors have called on Kennedy to resign. The latter said his assault on science should alarm every American. In Florida, the anti-vaxxer Surgeon General Joseph Ladapo said the state would become the first in the nation to end vaccine mandates for school children. He called COVID vaccines poison and likened the mandates to slavery. President Trump publicly backed Kennedy but expressed unease with growing restrictions on vaccines. "I think you have to be very careful," he said. "Pure and simple, they work." What the editorial said. "Kennedy's quackery puts every American at risk," said the Philadelphia Inquirer. "In just months, this snake oil salesman has peddled misinformation about life-saving vaccines, cited studies that do not exist, gutted medical research, and replaced federal experts with unqualified lackeys. His willful pigheadedness was on full display in the Senate hearing as he responded to bipartisan concern with bluster and disdain, but no facts or science. The CDC needs sensible reform," said the New York Post, "but that's not Kennedy's goal. With his tinfoil hat blocking out all sense, he aims to burn down the public health apparatus and rebuild it in his image. That means letting anti-vax idiocy run rampant while purging any person, policy, or idea at odds with his warped worldview." What the columnist said. Kennedy told the Senate panel that every American who wants a COVID vaccine can access one, said David Oval and Paige Winfield Cunningham in the Washington Post. But many Americans are finding the opposite. Amid new FDA rules that approve the vaccine only for those 65 and over or with underlying conditions, confusion is rippling through the healthcare system. Chain pharmacies in some states now require prescriptions. Some aren't stocking the shots, and many Americans don't know whether they qualify or if shots remain free, as in years past. Kennedy actually wants to create confusion, said vaccine specialist Paul Offit in The New Yorker, because it will lessen vaccine uptake. After shouting from the sidelines for decades, anti-vaccine activists are now making public policy. Kennedy is even kookier and more radical than most people realize, said Noah Smith in his Substack newsletter. In his writings and interviews, he has expressed doubt about the germ theory of disease itself. Modern medicine began with the discovery of viruses and bacteria and the use of antibiotics and vaccines to combat them. But Kennedy instead embraces the antiquated miasma theory, which blames disease on pollution and poor health, and calls for fortifying the immune system through healthy living, clean water, and good nutrition. As the nation's top health official, RFK Jr. is already putting his medieval peasant theories into practice. Kennedy's aggressive recent actions may just be the opening salvo, said Catherine J. Wu in The Atlantic. He's reportedly eager to yank mRNA COVID vaccines off the market. This month, his handpicked vaccine advisory panel could vote to restrict more immunizations, including those protecting infants against mumps, measles, rubella, and RSV. The formidable public health infrastructure that keeps Americans safe from infectious disease took decades to build. Now, experts say, America's defensive shields against disease are shattering in ways that could take decades, even generations, to mend. Controversy of the week. Venezuela. Was Trump's airstrike legal? Donald Trump's distaste for military adventures might be the only saving grace of his two chaotic presidencies, said Michael Fox in The Nation. Or it used to be. Last week, our supposed anti-war president ordered an airstrike on a small speedboat off the coast of Venezuela, destroying the vessel and killing all 11 passengers. Gleefully sharing footage of the strike, Trump insisted the target was a drug-carrying boat bound for U.S. shores and that the occupants belong to Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan drug cartel he has designated a terrorist group. But given Trump's track record of lying, there is no reason to take these assertions at face value. With 8 U.S. warships and 2,200 Marines now stationed off the coast of Venezuela, the administration is vowing more attacks on drug vessels. And Trump might even be considering a military assault against the regime of President Nicolas Maduro. Trafficking drugs is a serious crime, said David French in the New York Times, but we do not kill those suspected of being criminals from the air without any due process whatsoever. Trump is giving himself the unchecked authority to target people he calls terrorists with deadly military force. That means he has the power to kill anyone, anywhere, including in the U.S. With a vindictive, impulsive commander-in-chief, this prospect is terrible to contemplate. Actually, the airstrike was a good move, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In ordinary circumstances, the Coast Guard interdicts drug boats and detains the crew for prosecution. But Venezuelan capos don't follow Marquis of Queensberry rules. Tren de Aragua ruthlessly engages in kidnapping, extortion, human trafficking, and murder, and is now using those methods to shore up Maduro, a narco-terrorist who openly stole Venezuela's last election. The U.S. can and should depose Maduro in a surgical action, not a protracted war, said Arturo McFields in The Hill. Doing so would free Venezuelans from tyranny and signal to China, Russia, and Iran, Maduro's allies, that stability in Americas is a priority for the U.S. If Trump really wants a war with Venezuela, said The Guardian in an editorial, the Constitution requires that he ask Congress to declare one. Trump lacks legal authority to order deadly strikes abroad on his own whim, however much blowing up boats gratifies his love of macho spectacle. Trump also loves unilateral executive action, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. But without any court or Congress providing legal justification for these killings, members of the military and his administration could one day face prosecution for murder or war crimes. So we're left to ask, where the hell is the Republican-led Congress? We're not going to war with Venezuela, said Andres Oppenheimer in the Miami Herald. Trump's long-standing squeamishness about boots on the ground seems genuine. The saber-rattling is political theater to embolden Maduro's opponents and to appease Florida's Cuban and Venezuelan communities, who are rattled by Trump's mass deportation program, but loathe Maduro more. This display of deadly force is absolutely aimed at an American audience, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer, like sending armed troops into U.S. cities and having his masked secret police disappear people from the streets. The airstrike was another message to the rest of American citizenry that Trump's power, even over life and death, is now limitless. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for side hustles after the Trump family netted $5 billion in the first 24 hours of trading for WLFI, the Klan's new cryptocurrency. When President Trump launched the family-owned firm behind the currency last year, he pledged it would make America great again, this time with crypto. It was a good week for romance after retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, 81, married his former secretary, Fawn Hall, age 65, in a secret ceremony. In the late 1980s, North and Hall were central figures in the Reagan administration's Iran-Contra scandal, though North, in congressional testimony, strenuously denied they'd engaged in hanky-panky. It's a good week for speaking truth to power after a British employment tribunal awarded damages to a woman fired for calling her bosses dickheads to their faces. While the remark was not acceptable, the court found, this one-off comment did not amount to gross misconduct. But it was a bad week for the team of rivals approach. After reports that during the launch party for Washington's ultra-exclusive new MAGA Social Club executive branch, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent informed Bill Pulte, head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, that I'm going to punch you in your effing face before the two men were separated. It was a bad week for doom scrollers after a new study found that people who gawk at their phones while on the toilet have a 46% increased risk of hemorrhoids. We're just now understanding how much smartphones impact lots of other factors in our lives, said lead author Dr. Tricia Pashishka. Finally, it was a bad week for stereotypes. After data showed that out of 38 advanced economies, Germany ranks last in terms of hours worked a year. Chancellor Friedrich Merz said if Germans can't shake their new love for a four-day week and work-life balance, we won't be able to maintain this country's prosperity. And in other news, Roberts' order allows Trump to withhold foreign aid. Chief Justice John Roberts this week granted the Trump administration temporary permission to freeze $4 billion in foreign aid approved by Congress in its last budget. The Trump administration was sued by the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition and the Global Health Council to release grants that the administration froze earlier this year. A judge had ordered the administration to spend the money by the end of the fiscal year on September 30th. The administration argued in an emergency request to the Supreme Court that the order forced the government to spend money at a breakneck pace and posed a grave and urgent threat to presidential authority and the separation of powers. Roberts paused the order until the full court has a chance to rule. The administration has also asked Congress to claw back the money in a complex legislative maneuver that could run out the September 30th clock. The briefing this week is titled Pregnancy in America. Why is it getting riskier to give birth in the U.S.? What's changed about giving birth? For many Americans, it's become pricey and potentially dangerous. The U.S. has a higher rate of mothers dying in pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum than any other high-income nation, with 32.6 deaths for every 100,000 live births in 22, up from 25.3 deaths in 2018. The rates are sharply higher for some ethnic groups. Black women had a mortality rate of 50 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2022, nearly triple that rate for white and Hispanic women. That same year, Canada recorded 8.4 deaths per 100,000 live births, and UK 5.5, and Norway 0. The average cost of giving birth is also higher in the U.S. than in other high-income countries, coming in at nearly $19,000 for a vaginal delivery in 2022, or about $2,854 after insurance kicks in. In Germany and France, the total cost is about $2,500. Yet experts warn that pregnancy in the U.S. could become both riskier and more expensive in coming years because of President Trump's recent spending and tax law, which over the next decade will cut $930 billion from Medicaid, a program that covers 41% of all births in the U.S., including nearly half in rural communities. We need to continue to invest in public health infrastructure, said Rose Molina, an OBGYN at Harvard Medical School, It's very clear we're not getting better. And if anything, the rates of pregnancy-related deaths are getting worse. Why is the U.S. death rate so high? Doctors cite numerous reasons, including lack of access to care, the fact that more women are having children later in life, and that reproductive age Americans are suffering from more chronic medical conditions, including obesity and cardiovascular disease, at younger ages than before. Cesarean deliveries are also becoming more common, going from about 1 in 5 births in 1996 to 1 in 3 today. And surgery comes with risks, but the rate of women dying of delivery-related causes in hospitals actually dropped by more than 50% from 2008 to 2021, according to a study by the Department of Health and Human Services. Most of the women don't die in the hospital during childbirth, said Dr. Jean R. Guglielminati of Columbia University. They die after they've left the hospital. How common are postpartum deaths? About 22% of deaths occur during pregnancy, 25% within 7 days of giving birth, and 53% occur between 7 days to a year postpartum, according to a 2022 report from the Centers for Disease Control. Overdose, suicide, and other maternal mental health conditions accounted for 23% of deaths in pregnancy and postpartum. Excess bleeding, the second top cause of death, was responsible for 14%, and cardiac problems, 13%. The study determined that 80% of all pregnancy-related deaths were preventable. We are so baby-focused, said Karen Sheffield Abdullah, a nursing professor at the University of North Carolina. Once the baby is here, it's almost like the mother is discarded. Lawmakers have tried to address the problem. A 2021 law lets states extend postpartum Medicaid coverage from 60 days to a full year. And 48 states and Washington, D.C. have done just that. But health policy analysts warn that such progress could be undone by Trump's new spending law. What will the law change? The Big Beautiful Law will shrink federal Medicaid spending by 14% through 2034. Largely by imposing work requirements for able-bodied adults and by capping several mechanisms used to fund state Medicaid programs. Although pregnant women and those with children under 14 are exempt from work requirements, the time-consuming process of documenting an exemption could cause some to lose coverage. Meanwhile, the loss of Medicaid revenue could prove devastating for many rural hospitals and especially for maternity care, one of the most costly services provided by hospitals. Recovering the cost of maternity care was already difficult for medical facilities in rural areas where there's a smaller number of patients and a greater share on Medicaid, which pays far less than private insurance. What will that mean for rural hospitals? The cuts could cause 144 rural hospitals with delivery units to shutter or drastically reduce services, according to the nonprofit National Partnership for Women and Families. That would exacerbate the existing crisis in maternity care. More than 35% of U.S. counties now lack birthing facilities or obstetric clinicians. A Washington Post analysis found that the average driving distance to the nearest birthing hospital for residents of Kentucky would go from 31 miles to 42 miles if 35 at-risk hospitals in the state were to close. Those extra miles could be the difference between life and death. When somebody is in labor or having a pregnancy-related emergency, every second counts, said Rolanda Donaldson, a policy analyst at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Can those hospitals be kept open? Republicans added a $50 billion fund for struggling rural hospitals to the spending law. But that fund, the Rural Health Transformation Program, is less than a third of the money rural communities are expected to lose in Medicaid cuts. It is just a fig leaf, said Edwin Park, a researcher at Georgetown University's Center for children and families. Mississippi State Representative Tameka James Jones worries the reduction in Medicaid funding will lead to many more stories like that of her niece, Harmony Ball Stribling, who died of preeclampsia at 8 months pregnant while being driven to an ER 30 miles from her rural home. "We're not talking dollars and cents," said James Joyce. "We're talking about lives, and people are dying. People are truly dying because there is no health care in some places." Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We will read two from the U.S. What AI is doing to education. AI is demolishing my education, said Ashanti Rosario. As a New York City high school senior, I've seen fellow students rely on ChatGPT and other AI bots to write essays, solve math problems, and do both their classwork and homework. The temptation to abuse these tools is always there. During a recent lesson about Frederick Douglass, I watched a classmate discreetly prop their laptop up on a crossed leg and produce a ChatGPT summary of a chapter in his autobiography to hand in. I saw another use ChatGPT to produce a step-by-step solution to an algebra problem. Even on my debate team, students now rely on AI to create their arguments. Generative AI is so fast and effective that it has led many students to avoid doing any work at all. Students who rely on AI are actually cheating themselves because they're not developing the very instincts that we need to prevail in life: grit, critical thinking, and the ability to function smoothly under stress. Unless educators adapt to AI's revolutionary impact on schooling, this technology will produce a generation of young people who are unable to think or perform for themselves. Our complicity in football's horrific toll. Football is exciting to watch, no doubt, said Megan McArdle. But the thrill is dependent on young men destroying their bodies and minds for our entertainment. A recent survey of 546 NFL players from the 1988 season, who are now an average age of 62, found that a third of them experience chronic pain severe enough to limit daily life or work activity most days, including just climbing stairs or performing simple chores, far in excess of the 13% of similarly aged men from the general population. Former linebacker David Grayson, 61, says he feels such constant pain that the whole battle is to stay upright and keep going. Even worse, 47% of the players said they have serious difficulty concentrating, remembering, or making decisions, compared with just 6% of men in the age group overall. No one forces young men into football careers, which can provide extraordinary wealth and fame. Indeed, 90% of the former players said they'd do it again. Still, fans must reckon with the moral choice they're making with their attention and their dollars. Next time you cheer on your team from the couch, I just ask you to think about the crippled old men those boys will become. This column comes from South Korea. Is this how the U.S. rewards its allies? The Trump administration's mass detention of more than 300 South Korean workers was a slap in the face for our country, said Korea Jung-ang Daily. ICE agents raided a Hyundai LG battery plant in Georgia and hauled away frightened employees in shackles and cable ties as if they were hardened criminals. President Lee Jae-myung ordered a full-scale effort to bring them home quickly, but the damage has been done. It's undeniable that many of the Koreans were in America under sketchy temporary visas, but making an example of them was unfair, especially since long-term U.S. visas for engineers and skilled staff are notoriously scarce, and full compliance with all U.S. immigration rules is almost impossible. The crackdown came a mere 10 days after a Korea-U.S. summit, and the two countries have been following up with ongoing tariff talks. President Trump has pressured Seoul to spend heavily in the U.S. to help revive American manufacturing, and Korean companies have responded with multi-billion-dollar investments to make ships, semiconductors, solar equipment, and batteries in America. Only a few months ago, Hyundai's executive chair, Oh Sung-jung, pledged a $26 billion investment at the White House, to Trump's apparent delight. In return, we've gotten this political performance of a raid. Does Trump want our money or not? Last word, our feature article. Keeper of a Secret. Artist Jim Sanborn is planning to auction off the solution to a 35-year-old CIA puzzle, said Oliver Roeder in the Financial Times. But maybe not quite all of it. The sculptor Jim Sanborn lives and works on a small island off the east coast off the coast of Maryland, down where the state's long fingers reach into the Chesapeake Bay. It's called Jimmy Island, though he told me that he didn't name it. His compound is hidden behind tall trees, protected by a gate and serious-looking no trespassing signs. A security camera surveils its long, winding driveway. The property is occupied by structures of Sanborn's design and construction, including a large studio and a modernist house. The studio looks like a military installation, and the house is clad in lovely green copper. Farther back is a private beach and personal archery range. Sanborn himself is a giant of a man with particularly enormous hands. He is 79 years old, and his hair and beard are white. He is best known for the sculpture Kryptos, which stands in a courtyard at the headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley, Virginia. The piece is an undulating sheet of copper, like an unfurling scroll, perforated with hundreds of letters. It is framed on one side by a petrified tree, while at its base are a small whirling pool and two large flat stones. It was completed in November 1990, and has been furniture in the working lives of American spymasters ever since. Its placement in a geologic context reinforces the text hiddenness, as if it were a fossil, frozen in time, Sanborn said on the day it was dedicated. The sculpture's letters contain encrypted messages. Though they appear as one giant grid, Kryptos consists, in fact, of four sections, each themed and encoded differently, now known as K1, K2, K3, and K4. The first three sections were decoded by professionals and enthusiasts decades ago, and their solutions are public knowledge. The full text of K1 reads, "Between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of occlusion." The misspelling is intentional and meant to be deceptive. K2 mentions Earth's magnetic field. It was totally invisible. How's that possible? And something being buried and lists geographic coordinates nearby on CIA grounds. K3 is a paraphrasing of the remarks of archaeologist Howard Carter made upon discovering Tutankhamun's tomb. I inserted the candle and peered in. The 97 characters of K4, however, remain a mystery. It is one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world, a secret that has come to define Sanborn's life, now in its winter. It exalts and haunts him in equal measure. If it were possible to encode a mind, to distill a soul down to its essential script, Sanborn's might look like the text of K4, which reads, and I'll take an aside here, it's 97 capital letters that just look like mishmash, so I'm not going to read it out to you. I had come to ask Sanborn what happens to the code when its keeper is gone. He swiveled in his chair and answered, "We're working on a system to replace me." I asked him if it has been pleasant knowing something that no one else knows. "Secrecy is power, that's the unfortunate reality," he said, "and I have been resented for having the secret." His long guardianship of the Kryptos secret has been one of satisfaction and servitude. He has communicated with tens of thousands of people about the sculpture over the past 35 years. They write letters, place phone calls, send emails, show up at his door. The correspondence became so overwhelming that he eventually started charging a $50 fee to entertain submissions and questions. The fee covers an exchange of no more than 2 back-and-forth emails. Not everyone pays it. The interactions have become strange and sometimes scary. Sanborn said he has received death threats from would-be code breakers and envelopes containing white powder. At least one person has shown up on the island. "There have been Kryptos crazies that want to kill me. No question about it," he said. His voice is reedy and slightly strained, but always assured and matter-of-fact. But Sanborn sympathizes even with the disturbed and misguided among his sculpture's congregation. This is a piece that requires 2 artists, encoder and decoder. And code breaking requires a certain creativity. There's an artistic element to it. Creative individuals often have problems. We all have the same problems. In 1999, a computer scientist in California called Jim Gilligley cracked K1, K2, and K3. But when he informed the CIA, he learned that they too had cracked them months earlier. Neither was even close to first. A declassified memo from the National Security Agency revealed that its employees cracked them back in 1992. Sanborn had created a nice little puzzle, the memo says. A few redactions aside, the document explains the NSA cryptanalysis in detail. K1 and K2 are encoded with Benjenere ciphers. Each letter is shifted through the alphabet according to the letters in a secret key. The key for K1 is Palimpsest, and the key for K2 is Abscissa. K3 is encoded with a transposition cipher, where letters remain themselves, but are rearranged. But K4, the memo lamented, was intractable. At this point, 3 or 4 sections have been decrypted, and for those of us at NSA who've worked on this, and that number's in the dozens, no one has ever gotten that last part. Over the years, Sanborn has parceled out a few hints on K4. In 2010, he announced that one particular snippet decodes to Berlin, and in 2014, amended that to Berlin clock. In 2020, he revealed that another bit reads northeast, and announced that no further hints would be forthcoming, and then added it, that it was east-northeast. That's a quarter of the message accounted for, and still no solution. But the submissions keep flowing in at a pace of some dozen per day. A new wave has been propelled by large language models with their false certainty and ostensible suitability to the task. High in the current Google results for Kryptos is an article by a man proclaiming that he solved K4 with the chatbot Grok, and that victory is mine. Sanborn assured me that he was incorrect. The thing about AI is it's lying. It's telling you what you want to hear, Sanborn said. His voice rose. These people are so arrogant, they so believe that they have absolutely cracked it because AI has told them they cracked it. Congratulations. But Sanborn has long promised that even if K4 does get cracked by human ingenuity or some superbot, the individual solutions to cryptos will combine into yet another new problem, a metacode. In other words, he says, there is a K5. On a trek in the 1990s, Sanborn learned that he was only a few miles from Jornada del Muerto, Dead Man's Journey, the desert basin where the first atomic bomb exploded. It detonated the year Sanborn was born. Atomic weapons consumed his next decade. Piece by piece, through painstaking research and travel, he recreated the Manhattan Project Laboratory at Los Alamos, a project called Critical Assembly. He was particularly taken by the fact that the tiniest parts of the core of the bomb were made by jewelers. On the remove of Jimmy Island, he spent 3 years recreating old particle accelerator from notes and photographs. Sanborn's sculptures dwell on the moment when science becomes technology and when the beautiful becomes the terrible. That moment when pure science transfers into a technology is a very tricky time, and we're in the midst of the AI thing, he told me. In Atomic Time, Pure Science and Seduction, a 2003 catalog for his atomic art, he described his subject as a tyranny of the machines left on by mistake. Machines can take on a life of their own and end up with weighted symbolism, which can sometimes go beyond the human. One day, Sanborn and I met at CIA headquarters across the Potomac River from D.C. The enormous campus is surrounded by woods and is invisible from the public road. I pulled in, pressed a button on the intercom, and I was there, said I was there to see a sculptor, and gave my social security number. I was vetted by armed guards and turned left at the Mi-17 helicopter. When I arrived inside, Sanborn was sitting on a bench wearing sunglasses and a safari hat. We were accompanied by three agency minders. "You know, Jim is a very special friend of the CIA," one of them said. We walked down long institutional hallways past a library, cafeteria, and gallery of paintings, a mix of abstract expressionism and scenes of war. Sanborn pointed to where he thought the Department of Historical Intelligence used to be, but our minders didn't seem to know. "These halls are so familiar," he said. An officer unlocked the doors, and we walked outside. It was a glaring summer day. The sculpture felt lighter than I'd imagined. It seemed to float rather than sit. The CIA bans outside phones, so I sketched a picture in my notebook. From one angle, Kryptos was framed by two large trees, with a third flowering behind. The K4 section was largely and purposefully obscured by a rock. Sanborn hadn't been to the CIA in years and thought his work had aged nicely. He was particularly pleased with the growth of the trees, which were saplings when he worked here. They are now very tall. There was once a leafy hill, and then it was bulldozed and built upon, and now it is leafy again. I held Sanborn's cane as he leaned against Kryptos, his face near one of the piece's question marks. It was an intimacy with art, a physical affection that is reserved only for its creator, particularly in a severe place such as this. He took a seat on one of the large rocks and told me about his search for the petrified tree that frames one side of the sculpture. He had driven around Holbrook, Arizona, looking for the right one, and met all sorts of weird people. Once he'd found it, he made the slow truck drive to D.C. with the specimen in the back. contemplating the code. The last thing I wrote was on that drive, he said, meaning the solved text. It was quiet. It was perfect. A part of the world that I really love. We wandered over to the pond and grasses that he had designed to accompany Kryptos. Within hours after I filled the pond, there were ducks, he said. Back at his studio on Jimmy Island, Sanborn had asked if he could trust me. Then he placed a piece of paper on the dining table. I began to read. It was an unsent letter, part update, part apology, addressed to Kryptos, fans, detractors, sleuths, geniuses, CIA employees, cryptographers, and miscellaneous provocateurs. In it, Sanborn explained that I no longer had the physical, mental, or financial resources to maintain the 97-character K4 code section of my sculpture. He is entrusting the secret, the letter explains, to a machine. He will hand K4 over to an artificially intelligent system for safekeeping and verification. The code will be hashed so that the bot can't reveal it, only confirm it. It will be voice-based, though Sanborn hadn't considered if it would sound like him. Like most of the monumental pieces, Sanborn's final work will involve wrestling with a technology about which he is deeply skeptical. And he is auctioning off the system and solution to K4 to the highest bidder. The sale, which will also include Kryptos documents and a small copper test piece, will be hosted by the Boston-based RR Auction in November, around the sculpture's 35th birthday and Sanborn's 80th. The upper end of the pre-sale estimate is $500,000. That, evidently, is the going price of a secret. Sanborn's letter offered a final wish and one final hint. I sincerely hope the new owner will choose to keep K4 a secret. If they don't use, then, clue, what's the point? Power resides with a secret, not without it. This was adapted from a story originally published in the Financial Times. And we may have time to squeeze in one of the Talking Points articles. China, Z seeks to fill America's void. As the U.S. isolates itself economically and politically, said Catherine Kim in Politico, Chinese leader Xi Jinping is taking a big victory lap. Xi last week met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in China for the first time since 2018, then gathered with Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un and 24 other foreign leaders in Beijing for a parade in which China showed off its massive military buildup. With President Trump's tariffs and America First policies alienating India and other nations, China has started to present itself as a trustworthy alternative to lead a post-American world order. A furious Trump took Xi's performative gathering of fellow autocrats as a personal affront, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com, accusing him, Putin, and Kim of meeting to conspire against the United States of America. But Trump has only himself to blame. His punishing tariffs and cutoff of foreign aid are accelerating a shift of global power to the East. Trump's recent treatment of Modi in India has been despicable, said Bobby Ghosh in Time. For years, the U.S. has been courting India as a regional counterweight to China, but Trump hit the massive country with a 50% tariff, apparently out of spite. Trump falsely claimed he brokered peace in a brief flare-up of hostilities between India and Pakistan in May, and was infuriated when Modi declined to nominate him for a Nobel Peace Prize. Still, Modi has long viewed China as a dangerously aggressive neighbor, and he can't afford to cut ties with the U.S., which remains by far India's largest trading partner. Despite the show of unity, there's little chance of a China-Russia-North Korea-NATO-type military alliance, said Tom Rogan in the Washington Examiner. Kremlin officials remain deeply fearful of Chinese domination, and these three autocratic countries have too many mutually exclusive agendas to form a solid bloc. Asia's foreign leaders do agree on one thing, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic, that the President of the United States is an incompetent lightweight. Western European allies also view Trump as a petulant, insecure child. Their leaders mostly toggle between soothing his ego and working around him. Trump has made it clear he's a president with little interest in the world beyond what it can offer him. Don't underestimate the enormous damage he's doing to American power and prestige. China certainly isn't. On the poll watch, 78% of Americans support the use of vaccines to prevent disease, including 67% of Republicans, 72% of independents, and 93% of Democrats. And we will finish out today's show with a couple of quotes. First up is Ingrid Bergman, quoted in The Knowledge, who says, "Getting old is like climbing a mountain. You get a little out of breath, but the view is much better." George Orwell says, "However much you deny the truth goes on existing." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.